it's actually the duty, it's the evolutionary function of old people to look after the young people. You take the hits so that the grandchildren can be okay. So go out, get yourself fired, make a big stink about it.
My guest today is Peter Ridd.
I've been a scientist more or less all my life. I worked on the Great Barrier Reef since 1984. I'm a physicist by training. And essentially, I've been showing over the last couple of decades that the Great Barrier Reef is in wonderful shape, and it's not the basket case that you read in the media. We're going to talk about the Great Barrier Reef and why it's great. A very brief summary. The Great Barrier Reef is huge. It's, you know, almost as long as California. It has 3,000 individual reefs. Most are sort of a mile or two across. And of those 3,000 reefs, not a single one has been lost. They all have great coral on them. So that's a pretty good start. The measurements of the amount of coral on the reefs has shown that we're actually at record highs at the moment. Since records began in 1984 or 5, we've never had more coral. Because corals themselves actually measure their own growth rate, they have rings. Some of the corals are like tree rings. You can actually measure the growth rates going back centuries. And it hasn't changed. It's got slightly faster growth rates over the centuries. And what is absolutely indisputable is that corals grow much faster in warmer water. That's been known since forever, basically. But reefs are highly variable systems, so they get smashed by cyclones. You call them hurricanes. They'll lose a lot of coral. They'll have plagues of starfish, they'll lose a lot of coral, but then they regrow and everything comes good, and it's just a natural part of the cycle. But you can see this is great for the people who want to talk about the doom of the reef, because there's always somewhere on the reef that's being hammered by something or other and losing coral, but it comes back. And this is the thing, that if it keeps on coming back, you know you've got a very vigorous, healthy system. So it's a bit like a bushfire. We have lots of bushfires in Australia. Looks terrible when they've been wiped out, but they come back, and actually they need it. It's part of being the Great Barrier Reef. It has to be obliterated, unfortunately. It's horrible when it happens every few decades. Now, what you may not have heard in other parts of the world is that the Great Barrier Reef has not just been killed by climate change, it's also been killed by supposedly pollution from farms, but actually because the Great Barrier Reef is flushed from the Pacific Ocean very, very rapidly, pesticides are essentially not present in the water at all. Mud from farms, which is supposedly smothering the reef, has no impact at all, and neither does farm nutrients. So that's a summary. We'll just need to see what the reef is. This is the reef off the northeastern coast of Australia, that's the state of Queensland. And the Great Barrier Reef is a long way from the coast. So it's, you know, 20 to 100 miles off the coast in general. And there's 3,000 individual reefs. Here's just 50 of them. You can see each of these is an individual reef. It's just absolutely exquisite, actually, the form of this thing. And if you go back 18,000 years when the sea level was lower, all these individual reefs, this is one little patch of reefs, because they're these flat-topped, essentially hills about 100 meters high, a bit less than that. If you go back 20,000 years, these were just a plain of flat-top hills. And then when the sea level rose, there was a whole lot of flat-top islands, and now they're all being covered and they're just a bunch of flat-top coral reefs, the biggest system in the world by far. Here's a picture of one of the reefs. And actually, this one's quite interesting because it's quite common, actually, that you'll see that we've got lots of coral on the front of the reef. You've got all this sand, carbonate sand from smashed coral, and coral that's actually been eaten by a little fish, actually. Parrotfish and things eat a lot of the coral and they make sand. But this is a dead area on the top of the reef, and people, especially marine biologists, often mistake this as being killed. But actually, well, it has been killed. It got killed by sea level fall that has happened over the last 4,000 or 5,000 years. And because these are now exposed at low tides a lot, corals don't like being exposed, so it's killed it. We get sea level rise, that'll all come back. We get a meter of sea level rise. All right, I think this is the most important bit of data. It comes from the Australian Institute of Marine Science. It measures the amount of coral on about 100 of the 3,000 of the reef. So the coral cover, if you have a coral cover of 0.3, it means 30% of the reef is actually covered in coral. Now, there's other organisms on the reef. There's sand, lots of sand. So 30% is actually a pretty good number, but the important thing is changes. If you go back to 1984, well, we hit a low point about 10 years ago. This was after a few big hurricane cyclones and a lot of starfish plagues. But we've now got twice as much coral on the whole reef today than we had back in 2010, and that's pretty good. Now, these red dots indicate dates when there was massive coral bleaching, when the whole world was told it's the end of the world for the reef sort of thing. And you can see that we had these four big ones, supposedly. In that time, the reef basically more or less doubled the amount of coral. So that tells you a whole lot about what bleaching does to the reef. All these headlines you're seeing basically don't add up to a hill of beans. All right. Now, that was the whole reef. This is just about 10% of the reef. It's a section called the Capricorn Bunkers. And what I want you to see from this is just look how much it fluctuates. So we had up to 60% of the coral, of the coral reefs was covered by coral, down to 20%, then up, then down. These are cyclones, cranothorns, starfish plagues. If you go down to an individual reef, so this is just one of the 3,000 reefs, One Tree Island Reef. When monitoring started, in this case in 1992, well, only 5% of that reef had coral on it. It was a terrible reef. In fact, I know some people who were telling me at this time, the reef is looking really, really bad. But within a decade, it was almost 100% coral cover. So by the year 2000, almost full. And then it crashed again after a couple of big cyclones. And now it's come back and looking good. So this is the important thing. The reef is a massively, massively changing system. It's not like a forest in, you know, Canada or the western part of the US, where, you know, it stays pretty much the same from year to year. You might get a bushfire in some parts, but this is a system that changes. And of course, when it's looking really, really bad, they'll take a camera out there and say, oh, it's looking really, really bad. It's the end of the reef. We've lost 50% of our coral, okay, or more. Now, as I mentioned before, coral growth rates can be measured on the big, what we call the Parietes corals, because they have growth rings like tree rings. So you drill a hole in it, some of these corals are hundreds and hundreds of years old, and you can actually monitor, well, see what the growth rate was going back. Now, the color bars here are uncertainty intervals, so big uncertainty here. But essentially what you're seeing here is that there's really no change and certainly no fall in the growth rate over the last four centuries. This is good news too. So all this carbon dioxide is not having any detrimental effect. Now, you might think, well, maybe there is an increasing growth rate there, and you'd actually expect it because corals like it hot. If you actually, and this has been known, as I said, this is just, where do you go in the US to see corals? You go to Florida, don't you? And the further south you go, the better the corals. Now, there are corals right up in the north. There's actually corals in Scotland, for goodness sake. Yeah, coral. Scotland is a very, very cold place. But they grow really, really slow, so they can't build a carbonate platform. Well, we're in the southern hemisphere, so we're sort of back to front. This is the annual temperature of the water, and this is the growth rate of the corals. Southern Great Barrier Reef is cold for us, right? Northern Great Barrier Reef is warmer. The Torres Straits is right at the top of Australia near Papua New Guinea, even growing even faster. And then if you go to the Coral Triangle, Thailand, Papua New Guinea, and the rest of it, corals are growing even faster. So this is sort of, we have corals right in the south of Australia, but they grow so slowly, like the Scottish corals, they can't form reefs. Now, as I mentioned before, all our farmers are being told they're killing the reef. You've seen all this stuff with the Dutch farmers. They're supposedly destroying the planet with nitrogen. Well, our farmers are supposedly killing the reef by pollution from fertilizer and mud and pesticides. And it comes down the rivers from the coast and out onto the reef. But the point is that there are these massive ocean currents, the North Caledonian jet, the North Vanuatu jet, the East Australia current. If you watch the film Nemo, that's the one that Nemo went on. There's these massive ocean currents that flush in and out of the reef, and there is basically no pollution on the Great Barrier Reef. There is a tiny bit really close to the coast, but the reef is a long way from the coast. So this might be a bit too much detail. This is trying to look at the nitrogen. This is the stuff that the Dutch farmers have been in trouble about. So this is a cross section. This is the seafloor. This is offshore in the Coral Sea or the Pacific Ocean. This is one of these reef platforms. And then the water gets shallower. And this is the land and a river coming in. And this is the nitrogen flux, the amount of fertilizer basically comes in. And it's normalized to the amount that comes in from rainfall. So rain actually has a lot of nitrogen in it, which makes growth, right? Now, there's only twice as much comes in from all the rivers, and only a small amount of that comes from the farms, right? There's 200 units that come in from the Coral Sea, that comes in and out from the Coral Sea, and there's 200 units that are cycling across the seabed from various. So all you're saying here is, yeah, all right, you can increase this by a little bit because of what the farmers might have done, but it just doesn't matter because of these huge numbers and flushing that are coming. And you can do the same sort of thing with other nutrients too. And where's the mud? The mud is supposedly just, I was reading in The Guardian just this morning, we had a cyclone that actually went across here, right here, 4 or 5 days ago. And they're saying, oh, well, it's caused all this erosion on the farms. It's going out onto the Great Barrier Reef. But here's a picture of the Great Barrier Reef. And this is a typical picture of what the Great Barrier Reef looks like. Where is the mud, right? You can go out, and I work with geologists for, you know, a lot of my career, and you can go out onto these reefs and you can take a sample of this beautiful white sand, which is made of mostly ground up coral. There is no mud on the reef, right? It's just not there, right? Oh, there's tiny amounts. Of course, there's tiny amounts, but it's completely insignificant. So farmers are not having any effect on the reef. But I can tell you they are being absolutely victimized by all levels of government at the moment. And I just wish I could get our farmers to hop in their tractor and take the 1,000-mile journey down to, well, 2,000-mile journey down to Canberra and have a bit of a session like the French farmers and the Dutch farmers and the German farmers are doing. So I think I might leave it at that with that wonderful picture of that wonderful thing we have, the Great Barrier Reef. It's in wonderful condition.
Do you think we have reached a peak hysteria about the Great Barrier Reef?
Yep, I think we have. We're getting the word out more and more. I see it pop up occasionally in world media that they'll actually say, oh, the reef seems to be at record amounts of coral. Now, of course, they're making excuses, some fairly pathetic excuses for that. But we are slowly getting the word out. But I think there's a general distrust of a lot of the hyperbole and the catastrophism. Not just about the reef, of course, it's everything. And people are saying, I don't buy it. I mean, I think you mentioned that Rasmussen poll in the United States, where 60% of Americans think that climate change has become a religion designed to control us. Now, that's not because they're all expert on, you know, climate change and radiative transfer and the science. They just smell that, come on, guys, this is just too much. Everything, you know, you have a bit of rain and it's climate change, you crash your car, it's climate change, you name it, it's climate change. We don't believe you. So I think we have reached peak hysteria, and I think people are smelling rats left, right, and center. You can certainly see it in Europe at the moment.
Yeah, I think elsewhere I saw that you said that the end of doom science might be near, and maybe young people are waking up.
Yeah, I think they are. There's just so many things. The young people are not stupid, actually, and they're not so different, even though they've been completely brainwashed. Like, I mean, these guys have been utterly brainwashed, but they know they've been brainwashed, all right? You talk to them and say, yeah, we know we're being brainwashed, and we can see through it, though a lot of my mates might not be able to see through that, is what they'll say. I'll give you another example, and I know this is a little bit different to the scientific issues, but it's part of this brainwashing. We had this referendum in Australia about what was called The Voice, which was to essentially have an Aboriginal parliament, an Indigenous people's parliament, that would, you know, be a separate thing just for Indigenous people, a very, very divisive thing. And of course, in schools, everybody's been told, you've got to vote for this. Now, it's true that the young people voted more for that than the older people, but they were still in a majority voted against that, despite this 100% pile-on indoctrination that they've been subjected to. They can see through it. And I suspect we're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years, it's going to be the young people who were going to turn this and say, no, we don't accept all of this. And they could actually swing too far the other way. We'll see what happens.
Have you seen just the recent polling that I saw about young men are turning more conservative, but young women are turning more woke? What do you think of that?
Yes. And I've seen that even in a poll here about, it was about a specific issue, actually. It's another one of these non-science issues about, we have our foundation day is called Australia Day. It's when the first fleet arrived from England to set up Australia in 1788. And when you look at the polls, the men are very, very in favour of Australia Day. So are the women, actually, but not quite so, you know, crazily in favour of Australia Day as the women. So there is a difference there, which is quite interesting.
What are you seeing in the media right now in Australia? Is it Sky News still that's willing to have people like you to speak?
Sky News and The Australian, and there are a couple of newspapers, but we certainly do struggle. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which is equivalent to the BBC, is absolutely hopeless, but not quite so hopeless as the BBC. But no, it is a struggle. But, you know, we get around it nowadays, don't we, with social media?
Yeah. When we have a chance here, do you want to give just an elevator speech about what happened with you and James Cook, just for the people who haven't heard that story yet?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I was fired from my university, which I actually went as an undergraduate, did my postgraduate. I spent my whole life at this university, but I was fired for basically saying that there was huge quality assurance problems with the science of the Great Barrier Reef. And because of that, a lot of the work that was coming out from a lot of my colleagues actually was untrustworthy because there was no quality assurance systems. And anyway, I was fired for that. We took it to the High Court, which is equivalent to the Supreme Court in the United States. And we actually won on the principle that they had no right to tell me that I couldn't say that, but they still said they were allowed to fire me because they told me to be quiet about the unlawful activity which they'd undertaken, and somehow or other they were still able to keep me quiet about their unlawful activity, even though they weren't actually allowed to do the unlawful activity in the first place. So you work that out. The law is a funny thing. Anyway, I'm free now, and I can talk about the reef to my heart's content. I work for the Institute of Public Affairs in an unpaid position to spread the word about the reef, but also science in general, because the problem with the Great Barrier Reef is just one little area where science isn't failing us, but the science institutions are failing us and giving us bad science. We've seen this in so many things, climate change, even on the COVID thing, but I'm actually documenting many other things as well.
Actually, let's talk about all the different places where we can find more of your work. I discovered lots of them over the last day or two. You have your own YouTube channel, for example, or Reef Rebels, right?
Yeah, Reef Rebels. So I did a sequence of about 10. If you want a blow-by-blow description of about 10-minute videos, go to the Reef Rebels YouTube channel and go on the ones of the reef. But I'm also doing a series called Broken and Brilliant and Broken Science, where I look at certain issues and show how, you know, because science is wonderful. Proper science is just brilliant. But broken science is, well, I won't use the word evil, but it has the same effect as that. It's really, really bad. And so I look at some areas where we've got really wonderful science, but it's been let down by the broken science.
Okay. And then there's your 2020 book, Reef Heresy, right?
Yeah, there's the Reef Heresy book, but we're also bringing out in about 2 weeks, actually, I'm going to do this every few years, a State of the Great Barrier Reef 2024. It's going to be a sort of like a 50-page version with lots and lots. It's a scientific document, but can be read by the layman, lots of references. So that will come out in 2 weeks. It'll be on all those things, and it will give a good summary of the Great Barrier Reef that I went over in about, you know, 5 minutes at the beginning of this podcast.
All right. And I will include a bunch of these links in the show description so people can click on them, because another one is Plato GBR, right? That website of yours.
Yeah, that's been up there for a while. I don't do a lot with that. I just put the information up on the reef. It doesn't change. You know, it changes a little bit from year to year, but the reef's been wonderful since forever. So the website doesn't change very much, but it's also a resource where people can look at. It's actually a bit of a summary of the book that I wrote on the Great Barrier Reef Heresy.
All right. And then you're doing guest appearances on a lot of different podcasts, maybe like this one, right? When I just searched for them, I found quite a few.
Yeah, I guess I'm a bit of a social media tart. If somebody, it doesn't matter who they are, if a school kid contacts me and they want to do something, I will do it, even if they have an audience of two. In fact, I'm more happy to do that to an audience to two school children than I am to a thousand old crusty buggers like myself who probably would be preaching to the converted. So that's where the future does lie, and we shouldn't give up hope on the younger generation. Believe me, they have not lost their brains.
Excellent. How about the replication crisis in general with science? That's a huge problem still, isn't it?
Yes. Well, this is one of the things that sort of got me into the position where I was fired, because the replication crisis is where about 50% of the newly published science literature is actually, either completely wrong or serious flaws. And you can read about this everywhere now. In 2013, it was a bit of an eye-opener, and, John Ioannidis and his work. And when I found out about this, I really got pretty depressed about all my scientific... I'm actually working in a profession that's actually one of the worst, most unreliable professions on earth. 50%, fault rate. That's... how bad is that? And at that stage, I was having difficulty getting a lot of my work published. The journals wouldn't accept it. If I was saying, the evidence is suggesting this, even stuff where I was the undoubted expert. We invented the instruments for measuring sediment on coral reefs, right? We did all the work. We had more measurements of that than all the other groups put together. We actually even sold the other groups the instrumentation to measure it. But I couldn't get sometimes... and my work published on that type of stuff, because what I was saying was the sediment isn't getting out to the reef, it's having an effect. And I started to realize, we've got some really institutional problems here. And rather than actually just talking about the science, you've got to talk about the processes that have made science so untrustworthy. And this is what the replication crisis is about. It's not on Great Barrier Reef, it's right through medicine, it's right through everything, actually. And this is where all of us should always talk about the replication crisis whenever we can.
So you've been around long enough in the scientific world to see, you remember back when it worked better than it is now? Maybe 20 years ago you started seeing a problem, or how did that play out?
Look, I think we've had a problem for a very long time. Peer review is part of the problem. I mean, can you imagine a better system for making groupthink than the system of peer review, where for my work to get published, I have to give it to my peers who probably disagree with me, right? Well, they'll very likely disagree with me if they work for one of these institutions. And they are the gatekeepers for whether I can get my work published. I mean, that's how you'd program in groupthink if you had to. Now, remember, peer review is a relatively modern phenomenon. If you go back to the work of Einstein in 1905, that wasn't peer-reviewed. None of that was peer-reviewed. It really only started to come in the 1960s and, 50s, 60s and the rest of it that came in. So I think we've had a problem for a very long time. But when I look at the Great Barrier Reef, if I look at the 1980s and 90s, where there was a genuine debate going on about the reef, right? There was the geologist saying, look, it's fine. I was a physicist and also saying it's fine. And there was the biologist on the other side. What happened is that one by one, we were picked off, right? I mean, I did well to survive as long as I did, because a whole bunch of others were picked off, not in the same dramatic way, but they were picked off in the sense that their contracts were not renewed, they couldn't get funding, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or when they left, they were never replaced by a similar person. And what happened is a group of biologists, mostly biologists, who are often very, very emotional about the reef, took over, and they excluded any of the other people. So yes, for the reef, things were much better 25 years ago, but you can actually trace the problems that we have right across science, right back a very long way. Think of, the DDT scandal, the Silent Dawn, Rachel Carson and the
Silent Spring,
the banning of DDT, right? That was a complete scientific disaster, and it was based on really bad science. Now, we're talking in the 1960s there. So this is not a recent phenomenon that we're looking at.
So do you think it is a little bit better when people are putting these crazy claims up on social media, and then all sorts of people can look at it and rip it apart in 24 hours? I'm encouraged by that, actually.
Look, we would be in absolutely diabolical shape without social media. Now, I know that it's not as good as, you know, if you can get into one of the large media networks like Fox News and all the rest of it. There is enough of that, Sky News here, Fox News in the US, where you can see it on sort of mainstream media. But we would be in an absolutely terrible situation if we didn't have social media. So it actually makes you wonder about what other things have happened in our recent past where a large elite group have essentially taken over. I don't think it was as bad in the 60s and 70s, but it makes you wonder what was happening then that was not getting out. I can give you examples back in the 1930s where the media was acting as a group. For example, in the United Kingdom, the up to the Second World War, 1939, almost all the media outlets were for appeasement. They were talking to the, you know, the Prime Minister's office about appeasement. Don't let the word get out. Don't anger, you know, Mr. Hitler and all the rest of it. So they were all, you know, pushing in one direction. It wasn't the right direction. And you wonder whether this hasn't happened a lot. And it's only because we've been released by social media, despite the problems with us being censored quite often, that we're now actually hammering away, actually quite successfully, on some of these big ticket issues where the elites, or what I call the nobility, the people who are trying to tell us what to do, we can actually chip away at those people.
And you have said elsewhere that it's actually a duty for older people to speak publicly and push back against this stuff, right? Against the lies.
Yeah. Look, I feel really strongly for this. If somebody's, you know, I got into trouble. How old was I? Probably 57 or so at the time. You know, I've got superannuation. My house is paid off, and you know, I can retire if I really want to, sort of thing. If you're in a position like that and you can see bad stuff happening, and if you've got children or grandchildren, then you have a duty. And I'm quite serious. You have a duty to make an asshole of yourself and, you know, cause a flood. And if you get fired, well, so be it, right? Because the young people do not have that option. They've got children going through school, right? That it would destroy their career if they do it. So you have a duty to do it. It's actually the duty. It's the evolutionary function of old people to look after the young people. You take the hits so that the grandchildren can be okay. So go out, get yourself fired, make a big stink about it.
How about the whole problem of mixing maybe emotion and ideology with science, and some of these reef people are going out and crying when they see bleaching? What can we do about that? We need to be more like Mr. Spock, right? I heard you say that on a different podcast. Emotionless.
Yeah, Mr. Spock is an excellent scientist. He'd be an absolute rubbish politician, and you might not want him as a father, but he's completely objective. Now, look, it's pretty inevitable that a lot of people are going to be emotional about the Great Barrier Reef because it's so beautiful. You can't dispute that. It's unsurprising that people get emotional when they see a bushfire tear through a forest, and there's all these, you know, fried koalas that, you know, you're going to get emotional about some of those things. That's why we have systems in science, right? The whole way that science has come about is that we've got to be objective. We separate the emotional from the objectivity. We put in systems where, well, this is your data. Give it to somebody who may be a little less emotionally attached than you are, and let's analyze it. So you need to put in place the systems. Now, we don't have any quality assurance systems at all in most of science, right? If science was making cars like Toyota, 50% of Toyotas would come off the production line. They wouldn't even start. The engine wouldn't even go. That's how bad they'd be, right? We don't have quality assurance systems. So you need to put those in place, right? They do it in industry. They do it in lots of medical stuff, in fact. They fail in other areas, but they do that. So to avoid the emotion, you accept this is going to be there, but you put in place lots and lots of checking. You stop the groupthink forming, because there's nothing worse than a whole bunch of emotional scientists getting themselves into a teary tiswas. And you see it happening, right? Stop the groupthink. That's the first thing you need to do.
Do you think we actually need brand new institutions to do this, or somehow we need red team, blue team type of stuff going on in real life, don't we?
We need red team, blue teams. We probably need new institutions. Look, I proposed a little while ago that we need a center for science quality assurance. And, you know, I now know that all that would happen is that the scientific nobility would just take over that quality assurance system, and it would just become part of the groupthink. What we have to do now, and this sounds, what I think we have to do now, and this may sound crazy, is we've got to trust our politicians. There are some politicians that realize that science is really badly broken. Not many of them, maybe only 30%, but that's a good number, right? What we have to do to get the red team, blue team is that we need a budget line, you know, state of Queensland, where I am, there needs a budget line, Ministry of Environment. We're going to hammer the farmers again and stop them putting nitrogen on their farms. Let's have a red team, blue team argument. I've got $1 million or $5 million to employ a red team, right? And I'm going to do it as a politician, because we cannot trust the scientific institutions at all. You go to the Ministry of Science, you go to the universities, they can't be trusted. We can only trust some of the politicians to be able to select the scientists to do a proper red team audit of it, and then force the blue team to answer, right? See, at the moment, I'm a red team. All by myself, I'm a red team. Well, what does the blue team do to me, little red team? They just ignore you. That's what they'll do. And they do that brilliantly. But if this is a red team that's been appointed by the minister of whatever, this is what these, you know, and I can get quite a few scientists like me, this is what the red team has said, you now must answer it. And we're going to put this out in the media, what your answers are. Suddenly we have a debate, and I guarantee you, if you think the climate change thing might be a little bit of a scam, compared with the reef, that science is really, really solid. Right, really, really. There has, after all, been an increase in temperature in the last, 50 years. Whereas in the case of the Great Barrier Reef, there's been an increase in coral. So, you know, how does that work? So if I could get a proper argument, it would be pretty well the end. At least it would make an enormous difference.
Would Malcolm Roberts be on that list in Australia of politicians that would do that?
Oh, Malcolm Roberts, wonderful. Yeah, he'd be on the top of the list. But we've got others. We've got them in the mainstream parties too. Senator Matt Canavan is, you know, really tremendous. In North Queensland, where I am, all right, because we're away from the we're pretty sensible up here. We're very sensible up here on these things. Almost every single politician up here, even the Labor ones, actually, have got the so-called left-wing ones, they've got a pretty good idea that the reef is in good shape. So, yeah, there's plenty of politicians up here.
Interesting. So the people and the politicians that live in your area, they're not buying the whole Great Barrier Reef scam?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I mentioned this referendum we had on whether we should have an Aboriginal-only parliament, basically apartheid in Australia. Are we going to vote for apartheid? Well, in North Queensland, not many people voted for that. There were some polling booths up here where it went down 90%, right? Like 90% of people voted against it. Whereas in the inner cities, some of the polling booths would have been the other way around, 90% for it. So you're seeing this incredible polarization between the country and the inner city bubble, who have absolutely no idea where stuff comes from. We're up here in the country. We produce the coal. We produce the aluminium. We produce the iron ore up here. We produce everything, basically, for Australia, virtually. So we know that we have to be practical, whereas the people in the city have become totally impractical. And that's the big divide in Australia and America now. It's between the people who make stuff and the people who have no idea.
Is there any dynamic for a Great Barrier Reef tourism that some people want to say, you better come and see it now because it's dying? Or maybe that'll cause people to not want to come and see it because it's dying? Or
it's both, actually. There is actually last chance tourism where, you know, you talk to these tourist operators or even some of the tourists themselves, because I go out on some of these boats occasionally, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I thought I'd come out now because, you know, it's not going to be there. And, you know, I was really surprised how good it was looking. Yeah, of course you are, because you've been told a pack of lies, you poor people. But there is also no doubt that a lot of people are not coming because, well, it's lost all its coral. It just, you know, in The Guardian, they'll read, oh, there's been another cyclone, all the coral's been lost. Well, it's just not true. So the tourist industry up here, is it really in a difficult position? Because they'd like to say, actually, this is mostly a crock of rubbish that people are talking, the reef's in good state. But they have to be careful because they need a permit from the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority to go out to the reef and take the tourists to the reef. And if they say, oh, you know, climate change is rubbish, the corals grow better and better in hot water, well, that could be the end of their permit because the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority is, you know, top of the list saying, oh, the reef, it's all doomed. So this is one of the problems we've got. The scientific nobility and the nobility in general have control everything. So people have got to just say what they're supposed to say. And that's, again, why the older people got to stand up, because they're the only ones who can do it. If you're leaving the tourist industry, now's the time to stand up and say, I was basically blackmailed to say all this stuff. Now I disagree.
If you're having a conversation with a new person who hasn't really heard anything about climate skepticism, I heard you say elsewhere that you start by talking about the Holocene climate optimum. And Jennifer Marahasi says, let's agree that the climate is changing. You have any other advice on how to start a new conversation on the right foot there?
I think that, to me, and it will be interesting to try to poll people on what is the most effective opening line, that, you know, most people have no idea that the climate was hotter, certainly in Europe anyway, and Northern America, you know, in the 1100s, 1200s, or in the Roman period, certainly not when the Egyptians were building pyramids. They don't know about that. And that's a real eye-opener for them, in my experience. I used to give every year, the Townsville Grammar School used to come to James Cook University, and they asked me, this was really good, to give the skeptics argument for climate change. And I'd give a 20-minute talk, and I'd be able to bring everybody, you know, a little bit towards me. So those people, I used to ask them right at the beginning, are you a true believer? Are you a believer, but, you know, you're a bit skeptical, or are you you know, you're not a believer, but you're not quite sure, or are you a true, you know, you don't believe any of it? And I'd be able to bring almost everybody one step, almost, you know, towards the skeptical argument. And I certainly used to push, well, did you know that it was much hotter? And we have no idea why it was hotter. We have no idea why it was hotter in those days. It certainly wasn't carbon dioxide. I also pushed this Great Barrier Reef thing that, you know, that if the Great, you've been told the Great Barrier Reef is so bad and yet it's so good, what else are you being lied at here? Because actually there's a lot of people who question the climate change stuff. So that's what I personally use, though that might not work for most other people.
I just read on Twitter that there was some poor four-year-old kid that didn't want to turn on the lights when he went to the bathroom because he thought it was going to cause some sort of damage to the earth. And you mentioned elsewhere that it's kind of like a Harry Potter Dementor thing, that the alarmists are just sucking the joy out of life and scaring people. Any comments on that?
I compare them with Dementors as often as I can, actually, because they really just, as you say, they suck everything out of life. You know, you go up there and, what's that? I forgot the Harry Potter book. They drain every happy thought, every good feeling out of you. And children don't want to have a balloon at their parties because if it pops and runs down the river and into a turtle will eat it and the turtle's going to die. Oh my goodness. We're not going to have balloons at a children's birthday party. What an evil, horrible thing to do to children. I mean, how can you possibly do that to children? They've got enough problems, and there are enough proper problems in the world without doing that sort of thing to them. These people should be utterly ashamed of what they're doing, actually.
So, do you have any comments at all on Stein versus Mann?
Well, the main thing is, isn't it great that we're actually having a court case? Because that's a red team, blue team going on there, right? We're actually seeing Stein as the red team and Mann as the other team. And it's been heard in front of a court. We had a similar thing here in Australia just recently about a gas pipeline. So we make lots of gas in Australia, and there's a big gas pipeline that was coming ashore, and it was coming across an area of where the Indigenous people, the Aboriginal people, own that land, and it was stopped because supposedly the gas pipeline coming ashore in about 20 or 30 meters water depth was damaging some sacred site that was known from some song line. Now, this is a, you know, they have these song lines where they, their history is in a song supposedly from 20,000 years ago, for goodness sake, right? And so this scientist supposedly identified some waterhole out that once was offshore that was in a song. Anyway, it was absolute complete rubbish. It went to court, and the judge has absolutely torn apart the scientist who made these completely absurd claims. It was utter devastation. I actually feel sorry for him. He was actually one of my students or a co-student supervisor thing. His career is destroyed, unfortunately, but he was in this system and he got carried away. We need more court cases. So, you know, more strength to Mark Stein on that one.
Okay, let's see. Any other points you want to make before we wrap up? We covered a lot of ground in 40 minutes here.
No, I think the crucial thing is the Great Barrier Reef has got record amounts of coral. That won't stay like that. It's going to come down. You know, we just need a few big cyclones or a crown of thorns starfish plague and they'll be at it again. But in my view, the Great Barrier Reef is actually the best example of complete scientific institutional corruption that we've got. It's actually a good place to start because with climate change thing, there is this little problem for us. The temperature is gently warming at the moment. If it was going down, the other side would have more to explain. Well, that's the situation I'm at with the Great Barrier Reef. The coral's gone up. It hasn't gone down. That's got to be a good thing.
And you did say that if we happen to get a meter of sea level rise over the next few hundred years, that would be good for the reef, wouldn't it?
Oh, it'd be terrific for the reef because all these tops of reefs which have been killed because the sea level has fallen over the last 5,000 years and killed the tops of the reef, they will actually be covered with coral and then we'll have this massive explosion of coral. That's what we'll have. But unfortunately, the sea level is not rising fast enough, so we're not going to get that explosion of coral for that. But by the way, that is completely, most of the biologists have no idea about that. No idea whatsoever.
So you do think there are alarmists working on the Great Barrier Reef that specialize in this area, and they really are freaking out about bleaching because they don't realize that it happened in the past? Is that possible? Or what?
Yeah, because the groupthink has taken over. As I said, they're a bunch of teenage girls getting themselves into a tiswas. So their brain has just gone out the window. And yes, they really believe it. You've got to, the thing that I often get annoyed at is when people essentially say, you're an evil person for being a skeptic. You're actually evil rather than, I might be wrong, but I don't think I'm evil on that. The other side, don't think they're evil in the sense that they know that what they're saying is untrue. Now, some of them do for sure, right? But the most of them don't. They really believe that the reef is in trouble. They really believe that bleaching only just started in 1998, even though there's records going back forever. And in my report, I've actually got a picture, a lithograph from 1872 or something, showing bleaching going back. And as we know now, it kills almost no coral. But those people really believe it. But that's because the groupthink has taken over and the emotion has taken over. So they're not evil. We just need to bring the red team in and sort them out.
I mean, is there any room at all right now for a 25-year-old to go in there and do research with the rest of them and say the things that you're saying? Or they
not a chance. Out? Not a chance. Absolutely no chance whatsoever. The shop is utterly closed. That's why all that can happen is from the outside. It's why we do need new institutions because you cannot go, well, if there was a government that said for the Australian Institute of Marine Science, we're going to make somebody like me the director of that, and this is what we want you to start researching, we're going to fire a whole lot of people, we're going to bring a whole lot of people in, you could do that. I guess you could do that. University is much, much harder to do because they are more independent, but the government-run scientific organisations, they could probably be sorted out, but you need to be brave. You need to have a Donald Trump type figure. But I can see that happening, actually, even in Australia. I can see that as a possibility in the next few years.
Thank you very much, Peter Ridd. This is a very enlightening stuff for me. Appreciate it.
No problems. My pleasure.
Talk to you next time. Goodbye.